Oregon College Savings Program. The 529 network really has been a huge success for all of us involved. Michael Parker and his staff, and Michael sitting next to me, have done an amazing and an outstanding job in managing this network. This program has come a long way since I put the first few dollars in opening this program when I became treasurer 6 years ago. It is now more than $800 million in assets, and there's an account holder in every corner of the state of Oregon. Michael has worked hard to lower the cost to ensure quality investments for Oregonians under this program. Last month, in fact, our program was featured in the periodical Business Week for having the second lowest 529 fees in the country. I want to remind you that the 529 plan is a self-supported program, just like all of the operations in my organization. In the beginning, when this started, we actually had to take a loan from the legislature to start the program because we didn't have any assets. And since then, we've more than paid those back and have been self-supported since. Michael and I have been working with our counterparts across the country to simplify investment materials for families who are looking to invest in 529 and to develop a national website for investors. We also have lobbied Congress to make sure that all federal taxes that are taxed under this program are tax-free. And the President signed that bill this last August. I think this is a great example, the College Savings Program, as an example of how we can take a program, listen to our customers' needs, and grow it. Some of the things we want that drive this program are, again, public awareness. 529 is not yet 401k. Oversight of all the mutual fund managers that we have and disclosure of the investment options is equally important and a budget driver for us. My priorities have always been to make sure that all families at least are aware of this option to invest for further education and to keep costs low and investment returns high. And with that, I'd like to have Michael briefly go over his performance measurements and any questions you may have.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. My presentation begins on page 18 of your booklet, and I thought I'd go over just a little overview and a little history, a couple of minutes on where the program started and how it came into existence, and then talk a little bit about our performance measures and some of the Treasurer's priorities as well. So just for your reference, the legislature established the 529 program back in the 99 session. In fact, that was one of the Treasurer's bills that got this program going. We sold our first accounts in 2001, so we spent about a year putting the board together and putting the program together. The network is administered by a five-member public board. Three of those members are appointed by the Treasurer, and one member is appointed by the State Board of Higher Education. And the Treasurer serves as chair of that board. As the Treasurer mentioned, the network is completely self-supporting. Our budget is derived from plan participants who pay fees on the assets in the plan, and we get some additional resources from our private sector program managers. The network currently has two FTE, myself and one assistant. As the Treasurer also mentioned, the legislature gave us two loans to start the program back in 99 and one in 2001, totaling $390,000 to start and sustain the program for a period of two years. Because of the high success of the program, however, we were able to repay those loans early and not ask for any additional resources. So starting with the 2003 legislative session, we were completely self-supported. And also, I wanted to just quickly mention, it's fortunate that the legislature put this program into the Treasurer's office because we actually are able to benefit from a lot of the things that the Treasurer's office does. One example I just wanted to mention is, because we are obviously a financial program, we do benefit quite a bit from the Treasury's internal audit program or system. We have an internal audit staff that actually helps us. They help us monitor private sector program managers. They help us look at our policies and procedures. It's really a great function for us to be able to take advantage of those services within Treasury, as well as a number of other services that Treasury offers us. So it's a nice fit for us in the Treasurer's office. Just some quick numbers on the growth of the program to give you some perspective on how much we have grown. The Treasurer mentioned we're at $800 million. It's hard to remember back in the first year. We were at $33 million the first year, which is quite a long time ago. But by the end of our second year in operation, 2002, we're at $100 million. So, and now we're at $800 million. So it's quite a growth spurt in 529. And you've seen the same growth around the country in 529. Oregon has seen tremendous growth, and so has 529 around the country. Just as a way of perspective, around the country, there's $100 billion in 529 around the country currently. And since 2005, we hired a new investment manager and expanded our program options. And the program has nearly doubled since 2005. So the assets since 2005 have nearly doubled. The network operates three college savings plans, one direct plan sold directly to consumers through websites and our call center, and then two plans sold through financial advisors. That's hence what we call it the network. It's a network of plans. Each plan does operate independently of each other and under the same federal and state laws. And the only difference is how the plans are sold. Just quickly on our direct plan, really the Oregon College Savings Plan is our flagship program. That's the one sold directly to consumers. That plan will generate about $100 million in new contributions annually, and it increases every year. But this last year, we did almost $100 million in new contributions. 85% of that money comes in from Oregonians. As in many college savings plans around the country, our plan is sold nationally. Anybody can buy the plan. But because we have a low-cost plan and great investment performance, we do attract a lot of money from out-of-state residents, which is nice. And as Randall had mentioned, accounts have been opened in every single Oregon county, which will point back to one of our performance measures, talking about saturation in throughout the state. In 2005, the network adopted some new disclosure requirements that really help investors better understand what 529 is, how we can compare those our plan to another state's plan. If you want to buy, let's say you want to buy California's plan, we put disclosure principles in place to allow you to compare the plans. And so it helps investors really make a good, solid investment decision. And then these new requirements were really heralded by the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. It's a federal board that regulates our program. They really like what the states did as far as putting these principles in place and allowing participants to really get a good idea of what the plans mean. And the network has made it easier for investors to understand the fees that are charged and who those fees are paid to. So the fees are paid to our program managers. Fees are also paid to the state to help us run the program. We wanted to make sure the investors knew where the fees were going. Quickly, before I get into the performance measures, just some of the board mandates, our five-member board, as I mentioned. The board really looks at a number of things with the 529 program. They look at making sure that the costs are down. I mean, no one wants their investment returns eaten up by high costs. We keep our fees really very, very low. We make sure we have quality investments in the program. And thirdly, and really almost more importantly, is outstanding customer service. We want to make sure that once you invest in the plan, you have good customer service. You can navigate through the plan. You can change your investment options. You have good quality customer service through our call center and our websites. So if you want to turn to page 19 in our booklet, I will quickly mention our performance measures and how those were derived. With the board mandates, as I just mentioned, the board really likes to measure success in this program, and Randall can touch on it, with the number of people that we help. It's great to have assets. We need assets to make sure the program runs, but we also want to make sure that we really get good saturation and make sure most folks either know about the program and are able to invest in it. So if you look at performance measure number 11, it shows the growth of our accounts from 2001 to 2006, and you can see it's about 90,000 accounts currently in the network, and we want to keep growing that number at about 10,000 to 15,000 accounts per year. And again, the majority of those accounts are coming in from Oregon residents. But more importantly, the next performance measure really is what we're really focused on, and that's statewide distribution. It would be very easy to sell this plan or these plans, you know, down the I-5 corridor from Portland to basically down to Medford. But we take a great strides in getting this program out to investors statewide, Bend, Pendleton, LeGrand, Ontario, over to the coast. So what we did is we looked at a performance measure that allowed for us to track saturation. And if you look at what we wanted to do is look at residents 18 and over in the state and how many of those residents have a college savings plan. We're trying to get 1% of the folks in every county over 18 to own a college savings plan. It may not seem like a lot. Many counties have 2, 3, 4% saturation. Many counties have a lot less than that. So we're trying to get a statewide distribution of 1% of people over 18 to own an account. And then the other goal is basically to get 5% of the population to own a college savings account. Along with that is this, the awareness of the program in general, but we want to make sure folks understand it and then have the ability to invest in the program. So with that...
Chair.
Yes, Representative Beyer.
Thank you. Yesterday and today, as I was going through this with you, one of the things I've noticed is we have a number of charts, but there's a lot of information you're giving us that is not really covered in these charts. It's not like I want a lot more paper, but there are times I think I'm missing a lot, and I can't, and I don't have really any record of some of the stuff you're telling me, and it's been pretty much through the whole presentation. And I maybe I'm just unusual, but I just think I'm missing stuff. I'm hearing what you're saying, but I don't know that I'm going to retain it.
Mr. Sure. Chair, Representative Beyer, I apologize for that.
For the record.
Thank you. For the record, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. Actually, in our notebook, if you look at tab 2, okay. What we have done, those are the performance measures that we're talking about. So the information that we have pulled forward for the charts, the detail of the information is all contained in this tab.
Okay.
So the short form as well as the progress board report, so that the details behind the measures themselves, I think you'll find some of that information in there.
Follow-up, yes. And I see this, but again, I mean, it's still more numbers and not a lot of description on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I appreciate that. Part of the difficulty here is fitting to your format, and we'd be happy to give you additional narrative, whatever you want, to make sure you're comfortable with what we're saying.
It's
difficult. I'm sure every agency that comes up here, you know, is trying to figure out what the need is of each member, and I'd appreciate, we'd be happy to help you with, and anybody. That's obviously an open statement. So, in Michael's program, in some ways, it is one of those that has grown immensely, and there's a lot of parts to it. We have three different programs within the network. They're marketed differently to different investors, given the tracks of investments. There's been growth in all of those, so it's a good example of how it is difficult to sort of put this in something that's meaningful. I guess I don't.
Thank you. Quick follow up. I mean, and that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, is that you're adding a lot to this by what you're saying, but what's in here is pretty basic numbers, and I understand everybody's doing it a little different, and I understand the timeline. So
we'll be happy again to offer, still stands, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, anything you need from us, we'll be happy to give it to you.
Thank you, and sure. I certainly will take that up. I don't want to take the committee's time because maybe they aren't having the same problem I am.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, we do have a ton of information and be just happy to inundate you with that and sit down and explain it to you as well. So no problem there at all.
Are you saying be careful what you ask for?
That's what my board tells me when I find them information too. I kill a couple of trees. Okay.
Is there any reason that you can't go treeless?
We can.
We actually provide our board with a ton of information electronically, but then when we need to provide them stuff that they have to take with them, it's a lot of stuff is industry information that they end up reading and looking at the industry. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Let the record show that trees are a renewable resource.
That is true. Generally speaking, from Chile or some parts of that.
Please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So with that, those are the two performance measures that our board has approved that, again, I just want to reiterate, that really show the board's interest in making sure all Oregonians have access and understanding of the program, not just those folks that are within the population centers. So I'd like to then go back to page 18, just briefly, and just discuss a quick table amendment with the committee that really goes back to our performance measures and our oversight.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
This is now the second or third time that I've heard that expression used, and I'm just curious in what context we're using table amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the distributed with the materials on Friday last week were the budget document, the budget binder, which included a policy option packages or amendment request to the treasurer's budget that went through the process through budget management and was included in the governor's budget. Following that, there were two memos from the treasurer, one dated January 29th and one dated February 2nd, or 7th, my apologies, that, for want of a better term, we referred to as table amendments. They're asking you to consider additional requests or changes to the budget that was presented as part of the governor's budget. So those are what we refer to as table amendments. There are two. One was in a memo dated, again, January 29th. The other in a memo dated February 7th, and they were distributed to you. I didn't put them in your binders for that purpose, but if you can't find them or have misplaced them, by all means, let me know, and I will get you copies again. We will be referring to them in the work session.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, as the Treasurer and I both mentioned, the program has grown quite a bit in the last 6 years, and it's becoming increasingly complex. So this table amendment really allows us to do a couple of things that are really needed in our current environment. We need to continue to provide proper oversight of the program managers. And we're doing that in a couple of ways. We want to bring on and do a complete financial audit of the program on an annual basis, and also hire a third-party investment consultant. Previously, we were using some of the folks that work for the Treasury in the investment division. As you heard yesterday, their jobs are becoming increasingly more complex, and they're getting stretched. And as our plan requires more and more of this oversight, I think it would be it's prudent for us to hire an investment consultant, a third-party consultant, just on a project basis. They would not be necessarily on retainer. It would allow us to do a couple of things. One, to have this group look at our funds, our program managers, on an annual basis. And then if we end up doing anything like adding investment options or different things with the investments, that's something this group can look at as well. So we want to do a couple things. We want to audit the program on an annual basis. We want to provide additional investment oversight on an annual basis. And the third thing it allows us to do, which goes back to our saturation performance measure, is increase some of the public awareness dollars to make sure we're getting out to every county in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
How much are those public awareness dollars? And I presume you're using public awareness synonymously with marketing.
Correct. Chair Jensen, Representative Johnson, yes, it's a marketing campaign. Are you asking how much we spend on an annual basis?
Yes.
We spend roughly, depending on the timing, we'll spend about $600,000 on an annual basis to market the program. And interesting, I just want to mention, that's in-state only. We do not market the program out of state. We do not market the program to really financial advisors either. We market the program directly to consumers, in-state only.
Do you follow it, Mr. Chair? Do you get any... I see the ads on the television featuring the treasurer. Do you get any accommodation from the news stations?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we get, because we are considered a nonprofit, a state agency, we do get quite a bit of bonusing from the TV stations. So, for example, we'll buy a series of ads. That TV station will then bonus a series of ads based on our nonprofit status.
Where does the $600,000 come from?
The $600,000 comes from the plan fees paid by participants, and then we get additional resources from our contractual obligations from our program managers. So our revenue comes from two sources, one from people in the plan, and the second source comes from our private sector partners.
Could he elaborate, Mr. Chair?
Sure. We get the participants pay 10 basis points, so 0.1% on all assets, and then we get $350,000 annually from each of our two program managers. And that money basically pays for our budget, everything you see in our budget, and our marketing and public awareness program.
Is that contractually negotiated? It's contractually part of their servicing of the plan. They
correct.
Know they're going to tie $350,000 to advertise the plan.
Correct. What, Chair Jensen, Representative Johnson, when we signed these contracts, it was very important for those groups to make a commitment to the state, and we wanted to make sure that they knew that the only way this really works is if people know about it, and you can't sell it if nobody knows about it. So that was their commitment to us.
Thank you.
Oh, sure. I mean, obviously, as we market, the more we market the program, the more folks take advantage of it. The growth you've seen in the program really, I think, is due to a good quality marketing campaign and a public awareness campaign. So those dollars really, again, they're in-state only. They go for TV, radio, newspaper. Target folks in a broad way. I mean, we just get the message out to a broad spectrum of folks, and it really helps drive assets in the program.
I follow up a little on the line of questioning here. I guess my concern would be in your marketing, and I just as soon use that term as some euphemism for it, but in your marketing, is this a comparable figure to a comparable amount to what some other type of funds proposing to do the same thing would be charging for management fees, and I assume it's viewed as a management fee that you're talking about. Do you have any compare and contrast that you could provide the committee, you know, on that issue?
Sure. Chair Jensen, certainly. The 10 basis points that we take in on program management fees from the participants, that's fairly very, very standard in the industry. I'm happy to go back and put together a list of what states charge their participants. You'll see things range from 10 to 20 basis points. 10 is very, very common in the industry. And what we've also done is contractually with our program managers, as assets reach certain levels, their fees that they charge participants will decrease. So, and along with that same line, as you see that our assets get to a certain level, that 10 basis points will also decrease. We're not a for-profit organization, so we're only going to charge what's necessary to operate the program. So a certain level will end up reducing those fees. But I'm happy to put together a list of what states charge.
I understand that, but I think that maybe addresses some of our concern here, the comfort level that certainly anything is, you know, that's new has to... Even things that are not new have to have some marketing out there for the public to be aware of it. It doesn't do any good if nobody's aware of it. And I'm very appreciative of you know, of attempting to do that. But at least my comfort level goes up when I have some assurance from you that we're somewhere in the industry range as far as what we're charging for management fees for these programs. And, you know, if you do that, then I'm ecstatic, you know, we move on. The only thing, and I guess a continuation of this, there's some, maybe some concern as to whether or not you've grown as fast as you might have liked to, and I think the treasurer and I, you know, go back to day one in our political careers in this building as far as this concept is concerned, because in our very first session there was legislation introduced by both of us, I believe, tried to do something in this line. And I, you know, personally have to commend Randall for his perseverance with that to, you know, get legislation through. And I'm also very pleased at the success we're having with it. But it, as many new things come, are taken on, sometimes you grow faster than you're able to sustain, if you wish. And I'm just a little curious at whether our growth rate, we might have wanted more, but has our growth rate been in that comfort zone of what we can sustain, build on, develop, and move on, with it? And that's a value judgment in some ways, but, if you had anything quantifiable on that, that'd be interesting for me, too.
Be happy to do that. Maybe, should I just give you a... Oh, go ahead.
I keep saying this. You'd think I'd get over being new. I'm new, and I don't totally understand this process. So on this particular table amendment, is this money that you actually have available, you just want the authority to spend it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, that's correct. This is money that's currently in our account that we do not have the ability to spend yet without your approval. That's correct.
Maybe just to give you a little context of the oversight, and this has been a learning process for my organization since we started this, in fact, across the country. There is a national association called CSPN, called Savings Plan Network, which is associated with the state treasurers, because many treasurers run these programs. And that group, we're self-governed. I mean, these were authorized by Congress to say to states, go set these up, help your citizens. That was Congress's policy. 529 references the federal tax code. That's where these are buried. And one of the things we're trying to do is to make sure, as we're not regulated. I mean, these are state products. So much like the bonds you heard about, that's a state product. And there is a regulatory body that kind of oversees a little bit of what we're doing. They want us to be, one, have strong oversight. They're talking about disclosure. That's part of what's been driving this. The auditing and sort of the internal mechanics, making sure that we've got a solid program that is what the people are buying. Again, that's all being driven by the state. So there's sort of this national, we're trying to do the right thing here in Oregon, but also nationally. And there's, again, cost drivers that are even coming nationally for us to maintain some transparency, oversight that's also built into this. So go to your point earlier, Representative Byer, there's a lot of moving parts here, but I would say, and to the chair's point, we've been very pleased with the growth. There have been some learning processes for us, but I do believe Michael and his team and the board are really overseeing this in a way that you can be comfortable as far as making sure that investors are getting what they are asking for. They understand the risks of investing. And again, that's part of this as well. But in the end, that if they stick with this, we believe that they'll have something at the end of the their time of investing that they can use for college.
Thank you.
I have a couple of different questions. Michael, you said something earlier about the private sector fees, and are the private sector fees embedded in that point, in that 10 to 20 basis points that the customers or the investors pay, or is that on top of that 10 to 20 basis points?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, the fees, I'll just quickly explain how the fees would work. They're in addition to. So the fees that you would pay as a consumer would be the underlying fund management fees for the mutual funds, whatever that might be, and additionally 10 basis points to the state. And in this case, we've negotiated 10 basis points for the program manager to do all the accounting and record keeping and back office work. So the total administrative cost that you would pay would be 20 basis points and the underlying fund management fee. That all rolled up into one. In the Oregon College Savings Plan, you're looking at a right around 80, 85, 87 basis points, depending on what program that you're in, what investment option that you're in. The investment options vary. The more you're in equities, the higher the fee. The fee goes down. The lower you get into the bond program. That's total. That's all into you. That's total what you pay.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So, as an example, and it's because I can do the math. If you have $100 that you're investing, $2 would go for the fees, correct? and then there's a management fee on top of that. Because isn't 20 basis points going to be $2? Didn't you say it's 1/10 of 1%?
It's 20 cents.
20 cents. Okay, right. I just had decimal in the wrong spot. And then what would the management fee be on top of that?
The management fee to basically manage the mutual funds that the company is offering are going to range from anywhere from 35 to 70 basis points.
And follow-up, Mr. Chair? And how laden with rules is this? I mean, in other words, are there age limitations? Is there a limitation from a standpoint of when a person puts the money in to when they can take it out? What are the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, no. The fact is that when the board set this plan up, they took the tack that it's your money, and everybody's situation is different. So you can put the money in on day one, and you can take it out on day two if you choose. You can put the money on day one and leave it in there for 100 years if you so choose. There are no age requirements. There are no residency requirements. Anyone can own an account for anybody else. It's very, very flexible because it's everybody's situation is different. The board recognized that, so we didn't want to put a lot of restrictions on the consumer. I will say that some states are different. Some states can put on additional rules on top of the money. We chose not to do that because it's your money and we're just managing it for you in the trust. So there are no restrictions on age and how long the money can be in the plan.
And follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Going back to the marketing for just a second, have you been working with school districts to market this as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, yes, we work with a number of folks to help market the program. And, in fact, just a quick anecdote, the Treasurer has started a program called Reading as an Investment. It's a program to help kids learn how to read. We attach to that program through the school districts, and we're offering books to schools that teach financial literacy. So you're learning to read, and then you're learning about money. And we then take the college savings plan into the schools to help get our message out through the schools. And that. So that's one program that we've used to try to get into the school districts. We always try to make sure we get in with the schools. It's, as you know, sometimes difficult because they're busy, but it is one population that really will benefit because the kids are young. We want to catch kids as soon as they can. Plus hospitals and groups like that where the kids are young and people are having families. We try to get into those groups as well. So we do a broad spectrum of partnerships with different organizations, and they go far beyond just schools and hospitals. But we'll partner with a number of groups.
So, Mr. Chair, there's information available. If a person walks into Woodstock Elementary School in Portland, they could find information about the 529 plans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, no, I would doubt that. We don't have materials necessarily in schools. Like in the school office, no, we have not done that. We have worked with PTA groups though, so that it gets in with the parents, but we don't have information within the schools as far as just handouts.
Okay. And then finally, Mr. Chair, you mentioned hospitals and that sort of thing, and through DHS we have the Well Baby plan or whatever it is, where there's a visitation when there's a new baby born by a caseworker, which of course I kind of object to that, but anyway, the state has inserted themselves there. Is your information part of the packet that parents get as part of the new baby plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, it is currently not. We have plans to work with hospitals to do that. It's been on a kind of a one-off basis. We're really trying to figure out how we can do it globally. Same with the schools, how you can work with the schools globally so that it's not just going into each particular school, each particular hospital. So, yes, we are planning on figuring out how we can get into all the hospitals to do that as well. It is part of our program. Our board has actually mentioned that several times.
Senator Johnson.
To do that.
I guess I'm just mystified by that. Why not work with the folks that are already doing it? I mean, I can see this parade of people coming through the new mother's room. Hi, I'm here from DHS. Hi, I'm here from the treasurer's office. Hi, I'm here from God knows who else. Why replicate a program that's already happening?
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we don't want to do that. We are such a small staff. We want to work with the folks that already are working with these groups. That is correct. We don't want to generate another program. We want to insert our information in with someone else. So, for example, when kids take information home from school, every Thursday they'll bring their packet home from school, we could have a packet in there that goes home to parents. So just more of a brochure. So not replicating anything, but using those systems that are already in place to get our information out.
From your discussion, Senator Johnson, I'm wondering if the pediatrician has to take a number to get into
I was wondering exactly the same thing. And as far as reading as an investment, I mean, SMART is in this building hunting for additional money for books. And I'm just trying to figure out why it is that there's not a chance to piggyback on stuff. And I think you've answered that. But
okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson and committee, you're seeing the challenge, right? I mean, my opening remarks were I want every family to know that this is available. How do you do that? And we have a limited marketing budget. We can show you, we'll present that and follow on information about when we actually market this program, particularly on the airwaves. The assets rise immensely. So there is a response. There is a very good response. We don't have enough money to keep it up all the time. So therefore, that's one problem. Two, then there's how many partnerships can you create? And Michael's one plan. And I think your point is well taken. How many places can we find niches? Schools are one place. I mean, I think that the idea of using DHS program makes a lot of sense. It's something we can follow up on. We get stretched pretty quickly, given that we don't have a big budget, and hence trying to keep the cost down. And word of mouth. I think we have found that word of mouth is as powerful as anything with this. And once you get somebody investing, somebody else, they'll tell a friend or relative about it, and that tends to move it. So we're open to any suggestions because it is a challenge, and it's an ongoing one.
So are there books right now that say investing, what were they, reading is an investment, courtesy of the treasurer's office? Do those exist now?
Yes. And in fact, what we did was we set up, this is a reading program, but it's more targeted at financial literacy. And the idea here was we got our partners and this program to donate three books to every elementary library in the state. And those books focus on financial literacy. It's a program to help kids continue to encourage them to read. If they read two of these books, or we have a list of books that have to do with money or finance, they're very simple, interesting books. Then they can apply for a scholarship through my office with the college savings plan. So it's a way of marrying the college savings plan with literacy and, again, trying to encourage financial literacy. The SMART program is to encourage reading. This is a complement to that, and it actually focuses on financial literacy.
Representative Beyer and then Senator Bates.
Yeah, unfortunately, this program probably came too late for me. And whether or not I could have actually participated at the time, I think that is a little bit of a problem. But should I ever have grandkids, I mean, this is something I'd certainly like to take advantage of. And is that a segment that you're marketing?
Representative Beyer, I wish I had a nickel every time I heard that comment because I wouldn't have to work anymore, that someone wishes this program was available 20 years ago. But, yes, we do encourage and market to everyone, including grandparents, and many, many grandparents are in our plan currently. And the beauty of this is you can sign up, set up for your grandkids. If you have grandkids down the line, you can transfer the money to different grandkids. First cousins can transfer the money. So it's very, very flexible as far as moving the money throughout a family. So we do encourage grandparents to set it up for their grandchildren.
Senator Bates.
Oh, thank you. Two questions real quick. One is, do you have any idea what the average income of the families who are taking part in this program is?
I brought that information with me.
Thank you. And the second question is, the biggest recipients of this, besides the students, are the institutions that receive the money. And have you partnered with those universities and higher education and community college to have them put out a PR program to get people on board? I mean, they do a lot of advertising, and they do a lot of outreach to high schools, and even junior high schools now, to recruit students. It would seem natural that since they're recipients of the money in the end, that they should be a big part of doing a public relations outreach for you.
Chair Johnson, Senator Bates, I'll ask your second question first. An example of that, yes, we do try to partner with higher education institutions. One thing we've done is partnered with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And they have a huge network to get out to schools, and we'll try to do events with them. They'll have a night where they'll talk about scholarships. We also do a lot of work with financial aid administrators. I've spoken several times to their groups to get the word out as they're talking to students as well. So we do really try to partner with those groups that are talking to students. However, we want to make sure we're talking to parents of young kids as well. So it's trying to make sure we keep the parents who have young kids in the plan, because the earlier you invest, the better off you are. To answer your second question, the majority, and I think it's about 58%, and again, this is just information from the Oregon College Savings Plan only, so our direct plan. The income of about 58% of our households is under $100,000. So it's between $40,000 and $100,000 is where the majority of our accounts are. If you look at someone making over $100,000, that's about 20%. Someone making $200,000, it's about 6%. Those are household income numbers. We really try to make an effort to get this program to middle-income working Oregon families. It isn't really those families making the really, really high incomes. It's those middle-income folks that have money to invest for their kids' education that need the help. That's where the assets come in.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Oh, Dallas. Thank you.
Mr. Parker, earlier you said there was no age restrictions or limitations. I believe that's for the beneficiaries. To invest or open an account, isn't there an age requirement?
Correct. Thank you, Dallas. Yes, obviously we do not allow anyone under the age of 18 to be an account owner. Anyone could be a beneficiary, but you have to be of legal age to be an account owner. Thank you, Dallas.
Okay. Are we through?
Unless there are any other questions.
I'd just like to comment. Appreciate the questions that we've generated in responses to the advertising. And I hope members of the committee recognize the monumental chore that the Treasurer's Office had in setting a program like this up, because it is not just new to the state of Oregon, it was new to the United States. As the Treasurer said, we had to have enabling legislation passed through Congress, and that's not necessarily the easiest thing to get done. So there have been a lot of things that were necessary in order to put this program in place. And I guess on a personal level, I'm glad that you, didn't hire a big marketing firm to go out and market this for you, because I fear you might have been swamped, and it's perhaps better to grow the agency to grow with the program so that you're able to deal with it. Not that I, as we talked about it 10 plus years ago in committee, the idea was to provide Oregonians with an opportunity to save with some tax-free money, if you wish, for their children's education, much as they do for their retirement. So I think this is a tremendous program and a real compliment to the Treasurer and his staff in putting this together, working with it. I know you've worked at the national level, Randall, and my appreciation and gratitude on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
May I ask one question about performance measures?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay.
On the performance measures, number 11 and number 12, number 11 is growth, so it's the total number of accounts by county measures the goal of increasing statewide distribution. And so by 2009, you want to have 105,000 accounts. PM number 12, your total saturation of 529, your goal is to have a 1% saturation rate of college savings accounts for total population, and by 2009 you want to have 100%. So, in other words, what
I mean, that's great. These are numbers on a page. You know, the 105,000 could be 3 million. I mean, it doesn't really make any difference. Why? What does this get us? What's the outcome? What's the outcome that you're looking to get by having these numbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, our outcome is to make sure that everyone in the state has access and understands the program. And the way we measure that is looking at accounts by county statewide. What we don't want to see is a number of 4, 5, 6, 7 counties have all the accounts. Our marketing should not be directed just to those counties. This helps us direct our marketing plan. So if we're seeing where part of the state really isn't taking advantage of 529, it may be there's not a lot of kids there, that's true, but it may be that we're not doing a good job getting the word out and that to find out that they know about it. So the outcome that we're looking for is to make sure that folks in every county have access to the plan and understand how it works and how it would benefit them. And the way we measure that is to see who's opening up accounts. That's our outcome.
Clarification, Mr. Chair. Do you want them to have access to the plan, or do you want them to have access to college? I mean, there's a difference here. And I think that one of the things that we get mixed up with is, you know, every agency is doing the performance measures, but we're not looking at the outcomes. And the outcomes in this case, and I apologize for editorializing here, Mr. Chair, but the outcomes in this case, I don't give a rip whether they use your plan or some commercial plan down here, quite frankly, on a personal basis. What I care about is that they have access to college. I see this as being a vehicle for a student to have access to college, and a low-cost vehicle at that, because there aren't a lot of rules and there aren't a lot of fees and, you know, all of those sorts of things. I mean, 20 cents on $100 is pretty darn good. So I think specifying what it is that you want to have and what you're saying, so in the case of rural Oregon, where incomes are lower, college access is lower, there's a whole bunch of things about that, but what you're saying is you want a kid in Lapine, or you want a kid in John Day, or you want a kid in Ontario or Nyssa to have access to college just like a kid in Portland or Beaverton or Ashland does.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, that is a goal of this plan. I mean, the public policy and that Bob and I and others were arguing is that families are getting swamped and we're all concerned about with debt, right? They're, one way or the other, if families committed to sending a child to school, they're going to do it. And often that is occurring in the case where people are just coming out the back end with a massive debt. And I know the governor's been very worried about that as well. So this is one tool to help families at least mitigate some of that debt. Doesn't mean you're going to completely pay for your college with this. It can if you have the resources, but primarily it's a way to help absorb that impact. And access to me is affordability, and that's a bigger question than what this plan can do in and of itself, but the idea was to help people put money aside. They've got to make that choice, and that's the challenge here. This isn't a mandated thing. This is, you know, again, partnering, trying to get the public aware of it, and having them put their own dollars in and trust that somehow that we will manage this money in a way that will give them a return and that return will at least help them pay for college. And you're hitting on a big problem. I mean, it's a big problem for this state. It's a big problem for this country. Tuitions continue to skyrocket. This is a tool, but it isn't the only tool.
Okay. Can I just quickly follow up on that, Mr. Chair? Representative Cromwell, you're exactly right. The board has always talked about putting more kids into school. One thing that this plan, I think, does do is it raises the awareness of what college actually costs. When we do a presentation and we talk about college is very expensive, so we want folks to know it isn't a pay-as-you-go system anymore. I mean, when I went to school, you know, I worked in the summertime and took a small loan and I could get through. It's very, very difficult for students to do that now. There's debt, there's scholarships, and there's savings. This is a way for let people know, look, you need to plan for it like you're planning for your retirement. I think that's part of what this plan can actually afford and give to participants is plan for it. Don't just try to do it when your kid's 17 or 18 years old.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Great. the next item we want to discuss with you is a policy bill, Senate Bill 67, which is in Ways and Means, and it will impact our budget. Mike Currier from the Governor's Office is going to join me, but this last discussion went on beyond his time he could be here. He actually had to go up and be with the Governor, but he did say he'd be happy to talk to you individually about this policy change. This was a bill that was introduced by the Governor on behalf of the Land Board to transfer the unclaimed property program from the Department of State Lands to the Office of State Treasurer. The bill itself passed unanimously in the Senate Education and General Government Committee and has been, as I said, referred to Ways and Means. This was this transfer was part of the Governor's recommended budget, which impacted both my budget as well as Department of State Lands. The Land Board, which is, again, made up of the Governor, myself, and the Secretary of State, I want to remind you, are fiduciaries to the Common School Fund, for which now, as we described yesterday, is well over $1 billion. And we're constantly looking for ways in which we can make sure to improve the programs that help fund that that help fund the Common School Fund and to help, in the end, Oregon schools. For that reason, the Land Board has decided that the administration of the Unclaimed Property Program currently housed in the Department of State Lands should be transferred to the Office of Treasurer. The move, we believe, the three of us believe, will improve this program by increasing collections of unclaimed property, help more people find that property, and increase the Common School Fund. More will be said about that, but approximately $250 million of unclaimed property assets are now part of the Common School Fund, for which we make investments, investment earnings that then go out to the schools in the state of Oregon. This move makes a lot of sense, and I think Louise Soliday, the director of the Department of State Lands, said it best when she presented this bill before the Senate committee, saying, quote, if someone is looking for their property, the last place they'd look for it is at DSL. That is true. This transfer is a win for Oregonians, it's a win for schools, and it would be a win for all of us. By moving unclaimed property to the Treasurer's Office, the program will be greatly enhanced with improved technology, stronger accountability and enforcement of collection laws, and greater awareness of this program. Further timing of this move is couldn't be better. As we discussed yesterday, my office needs to move as is. This is a perfect time to move this program into my office as we move the entire agency. This isn't a difficult transfer. In fact, most states have the state treasurer overseeing the unclaimed property programs. The National Association of State Treasurers, just like I was describing with the College Savings Plan Network, worked on a national basis as well to improve these programs statewide and also to look at national issues affecting them. We just showed you that the 529 plan is something where we can take a program and grow it. This is very, very similar. So with that, I'd like to have Cindy Wickham and Darren Bond from my office come up and maybe describe a little bit about what an unclaimed property is, how this program works, and how we believe this is the right thing for the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
As they come up, I'd like to touch on a couple of things the Treasurer said and just ask some questions to set up background against which we can have this conversation. You said that your entire office was moving.
Yes.
Where?
We made that point yesterday. We are working on part of our budget request. We need to have the authorization, and Linda can give you more detail. But part of our request is moving the state treasurer's office as a result of the request that we put in yesterday of the staff we need.
I must have missed that conversation. How much is the move budgeted for?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, most of the cost is included in this policy option package. A table amendment or a table request of in excess of $800,000 was presented or referred to yesterday. I believe the total cost of the move is in excess of $3 million, and that anticipates about 32,000 square feet of office space. It would be private office space somewhere around Salem.
I guess the disconnect for me is that in different subcommittees, we're talking about the to be explicit in Department of Administrative Services budget that Senator Whitsitt and I sit on that panel, we're talking about a request to build another office building on the mall with an indeterminate client mix. And do you anticipate going into that building or going into private space now?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we are going to be having discussions with the capital planning group as far as what availability there is with DAS. Our current understanding is there's nothing available for the size that Dallas has mentioned. We do have a timing issue from a standpoint of the transfer of the unclaimed property program, and where we are right now with the positions that we've asked for and discussed yesterday, we don't have space for them. And so it's trying to coordinate our total ask with the capital planning group and when the building's going to be built. So there's more discussions to happen subsequent to the hearing here.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
The difficulty I have is based on what you just said, mm-hmm. it sounds as though the unclaimed property tail is wagging the whole space dog. Because how many moves would you anticipate making? What I'm trying to get to is what's broken right now that would cause you guys to have to take the unclaimed property activities, that would cause you to have 32,000 feet of space, when we haven't, to the best I can tell, had a thoughtful discussion with DAS about property real estate needs. There hasn't been a thoughtful discussion about the remodel in this building and where the offices of the Secretary of State and the Treasurer are going to go. It just seems to me, in sitting through these two hearings, both the DAS budget and now here, that there's a complete disconnect. And it feels preliminarily as though you guys are saying, we need to go get our own space and we'll sort it all out later. I'm trying to figure out how many moves are you going to make, assuming that maybe you would go back into the DAS space. And I'm trying to figure out if DAS space is cheaper, why would you be out looking for 32,000 square feet of private space when with a little bit of planning, maybe we could amalgamate the whole thing in one jump? Because DAS indicated to us that a conversation with the Secretary of State and the Treasurer's Office was part of the $40 million for a new building on the Mall. And I just, it looks like a box of mice somebody tipped over, and I don't know where the coordinated planning is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson,
for the record, please.
For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasurer. Our intent, should we move, wouldn't be to move to the new one of the new buildings DAS is planning because of these kinds of expenses that we would incur.
What kind of sorry, Mr. Chair?
Moving expenses. I mean, should we undertake spend $3.4 million or there whatever it takes for us to move the organization to a new facility, it wouldn't make sense to 4 years from now or 5 years from now when DAS gets the buildings completed to move again and incur those costs again.
So you're closing the door right now and going into the DAS building on the Mall?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I could ask. Our understanding, we've understood that building, I come up the red lot. Mm-hmm. That's, and there has been
yellow lot.
Yellow.
Confusing my colors. That the timeline to get that up and moving will not meet the needs that we have today, which, again, the tail isn't unclaimed property, actually. It is the fact that we need more space today for my organization as it stands, which was our budget presentation yesterday, including the request for additional staff. That's why I said it's a perfect time to talk about moving unclaimed property to my office because I want to move just once, and this organization should just move once. If you have a timeline that could meet our needs, I mean, we have been scoping out where we might look. We've looked at both of those lots. There was a discussion that the red lot, I think, was going to go first. That might change, but that was considerably years out, and we don't have the time to wait for years out. That was our problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we began the discussion with DAS, and that's where we started, and they don't have space for us. So that's pushed us to look at other alternatives, and you know, we'd be more than happy to move into a DAS space if it was available. It's just our understanding it's not.
How severe is your space problem? Maybe you covered this yesterday.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't believe we did. We have, you know, we've filled up our space now, and we're, with our organic growth that we have, that we see before us, we're growing out of it. and we have nowhere to put unclaimed property. We don't have places to put the growth in the investment division and the debt management division and the information systems division. And so we're simply, you know, the demands on Treasury are increasing. And as we discussed yesterday, we're trying to address those increasing demands with the resources necessary to manage it. And that is pushing us out of the facility that we're currently in.
Senator Johnson, if I could editorialize a little here, I guess, or fill in some of the blanks, at least as far as I see it. It strikes me that both in terms of the DAS budget and their requests and what they're doing, and in terms of the Treasurer's Office, that there may have been some piecemeal planning, but there hasn't been any real, what I would perceive as good systematic planning for a whole bunch of things on these. And yet, at least is our hope that we will kind of facilitate bringing that planning around, though it may be a day or two late in the process of doing it, sort of thing.
I hope so, Mr. Chair, because it doesn't strike me that this building, we're talking about a monumental investment in this building, and I just don't know at what touch points the Secretary of State's office and the Treasurer's office space has been coordinated with what's happening in this building. It just feels like there's not real clear planning.
I appreciate your comments on this and appreciate your thoughts with it. It certainly has a similar feeling for me. And you have a little longer history with this committee than I have, so you're probably more...
Well, and why don't I zip it and let them make their presentation?
Yes. Proceed, please. Further action.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sidhu Wickham. I'm an unclaimed property manager at the Oregon Department of State Lands. I came in today to provide you just a little bit of an overview of the unclaimed property program. Historically, the unclaimed property traces back to British common law, and it's evolved over time. And the original Model Act was created by the Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws in 1954, and that set the stage to put unclaimed property under the state's jurisdiction. All 50 states, as well as some of the Guam, Puerto Rico, some of the Canadian provinces, have a version of unclaimed property law. Oregon statutes were originally enacted in 1957, and we are based on the 1981 Uniform Act. Unclaimed property is primarily intangible property. It can be anything from an uncashed paycheck to a lost bank account, dividends from stocks, the actual stock shares themselves, mutual funds, accounts payable, checks, just a wide variety of instruments, any obligation that is owed by a business or a governmental entity to a person where that person cannot be contacted as unclaimed property. There's also a small amount of tangible property that we receive, which are the contents from safe deposit boxes after a certain period of time. When an owner cannot be contacted by the business, which we call the holder of the property, then the dormancy period or the abandonment period starts ticking, and they have certain responsibilities to try to find that owner. And upon a certain period, after the time has expired, then they're required to turn that over to the state. Once we get the property into the state, our staff begin the process of recording the owner information as provided by the holder. We process those reports into our database and make them available for claim. When the report is completed, we post the names of all the owners with a property value of over $10 on our website. And then for other amounts that are, like right now, I think $5,000 or more, we do some additional searching for owners. Approximately 80% of our claims inquiries are a result of people finding their names on the Internet. The state never assumes ownership of the property, and instead we maintain it in protective custody. And as the Treasurer mentioned earlier, we currently hold just over $250 million. We have over 1 million names in our database. The earnings are distributed as part of the Common School Fund distribution to the schools on a semiannual basis. And that's just a quick thumbnail sketch. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I'll answer any questions.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Ms. Wickham, I had an interesting personal experience with your agency.
Mike.
last summer, a friend of my wife's pointed out that you held some unclaimed property for us, and so the next time we were in Salem, we walked across the mall and visited the agency. We were told that you didn't know, your agency didn't know or couldn't tell us the amount of the property or the nature of the property, but that if we filled out a form and had it notarized and brought it back, that you could tell us within 6 to 8 weeks. So we filled out the form, and then at my insistence, I did ask that somebody there at the DSO come out and notarize it. When the lady came out to notarize it, there was no place on the form to notarize it. So she went back and got a paper and attached the notarized form. Okay. So Gail and I walked back across the mall to the Senate office, and I picked up the phone and called Ann Hannes and asked her to come over the next day, and we chatted. She was able to tell me the next day the nature of the abandoned property and the value of it. She pointed out that to return the money had to come, there had to be a check cut by DAS in order to get the money, but it would be a few weeks. And to fast forward the story, there was a check in the mail in 4 days. I don't know which is more offensive, that because I'm a senator I got it in 4 days, or that it normally takes 6 to 8 weeks. There seems to be a disconnect there between work time and elapsed time. And there also, I don't know whether that's a people problem or a systems problem, but it would certainly, from my experience, there's certainly a problem there. And then one other question while I have the mic. I see that by transferring the unclaimed property division to the treasurer's office, that we're going to improve the amount of money that's returned to the people, the rightful owners, and also increase the common school fund. And I need an explanation of that, because by increasing the amount of money going back to the rightful owner, which is the right thing to do, you're going to reduce the corpus that draws interest. So could you explain that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsett, I can address the first question, but I'll let the Treasurer's Office address your second question. As far as the processing time on our claims, we typically tell people 6 to 8 weeks, because we don't, until we actually get into the review of the claim, we don't know what all information we're going to need or how much response time it's going to take for the claimant to get back to us with information. So we tend to overestimate the amount of time. Currently, we're processing claims that were received yesterday are being processed by my staff today. We've managed to turn in 4 years, 137-day turnaround time into less than 24 hours in most cases. But we don't promise a check in 4 days, because I can't guarantee that.
Follow up.
The experience that I had was more of a passive-aggressive, we'll get to it when we get to it, to the point where I actually was concerned enough that I did call the director and ask her to come over and visit with us. So that's the reason I brought the subject up. But it certainly appears to me that, if you are, in fact, turning them around in 24 hours, and I can't imagine why someone would tell me 6 to 8 weeks, but fine.
Maybe I could answer the second question after Darren goes, because I think part of what we believe know is that in my office, with technology and the way we can reach out to those who are holding the property and enforcing the law to collect more assets, that will bring in more unclaimed property. And I think what was described is every year this program collects property across the state. The goal is to find the rightful owner. That is what this is program's about. But you don't find everybody. They're all over the country often. So the way our laws are set up, that money then sits in the top of someone's pocket. Oh, sorry about that. In which case, the money then benefits because it's part of the corpus that earns interest that goes out to school. So that's where we believe the net policy change will be more assets collected, more assets returned, but the overall, there will be more assets sitting in the common school fund that will earn more interest. That's the thing. And we've seen this when you've moved these programs, which have happened across the country into treasurer's office. We do have that information to show you that they do grow when they are brought into my office. Maybe Darren can talk a little bit about how we would run this program within my organization.
Senator Johnson had a question.
Before we move to that, I want to go back to DSL. It strikes me that a couple of sessions ago, if my memory is correct, DSL was subject to some pretty harsh criticism in this hallway about the management of unclaimed property, the condition of the safe, the condition of some of the physical safeguards for tangible assets. And I think you were directed to go forth and remedy, and I believe that that's happened. My curiosity is, how much money was expended to bring some of your security procedures up to passable grade condition?
Chair Jensen and Senator Johnson, I don't have those numbers, but I can get those for you.
My point, I think they're very important numbers, because my point is that within a biennium ago, or perhaps a little bit more, you guys were instructed to spend a lot of money to bring your physical custody procedures up to speed, and now I presume we're talking in a move about moving them, and I'd like to know how much you expended on the one side of the equation, and then on the other side of the equation, how much the Treasurer's Office anticipates spending to do the same physical custody that's already in place right now. And one other question, just to nuance it further, I don't know the commercial real estate market in Salem very well, but I'm trying to ascertain the availability of 32,000 square feet, and also what retrofit to the building would have to be made to house physical custody, and at what expense.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if I might speak to that, is that there's probably no organization in the state that prizes security, both physical and virtual, more than the Treasurer's Office. We've been a leader in providing security both within our facility, but also within the systems that we manage, and by extension, pushing that out to state agencies and their interactions with us. We have security. We have a secure car key system in the building. We have secure vaults.
I'm not disputing your high regard for security. What I'm getting at is the legislature directed DSL to spend money. They did, in order to assure security. And we're now abandoning that investment if this moves forward and paying more for additional security. I'm just trying to get the numbers.
Senator Johnson, we'll bring the vaults that they've installed will come with us. As far as security, any facility that we would build anyway would have all of the physical security. We deploy a lot of the controls that were put in place at DSL were just basic internal controls, dual control issues and things like that, that are a standard part of the way we do business. We deal with bearer bonds in the Treasurer's Office. So we're used to dealing ourselves with physical assets, you know, valuable assets.
I'm not disputing any of that. I just want the numbers.
Okay. We don't. We'll get those numbers to you, both in terms of what it cost us and then what it would cost the...
How long ago DSL did, at how much cost, and what you anticipate the cost would be, and whether or not you anticipate having to, you said build something?
Move their vaults.
Okay. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. The question that comes to my mind is, why not just simply manage the abandoned property division right where it's at and change the management to the Treasurer's Office? They're in place. They're, you know, I mean, they have space. I mean, what if they move out of DSL?
Does DSO have something to put in their place, or are they crowded for space, or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we believe that most effectively we'll be able to manage the organization if it's within Treasury physically as well as organizationally. We've found across the country, the Oregon where unclaimed property has been moved into the Treasurer's office, the uniform cry is that you have to bring them into the organization to be able to realize the efficiencies that can be gained. We can effectively manage them. We are at our core a customer service organization. I think that's very evident through the results of our customer survey, and we can imbue that culture with that. But I think it's really important for us to be able to effectively manage them, for them to realize the synchronicities that they have with our office, to be able to readily take advantage of the higher level accountants, including CPAs that are in the office. To be able to really take maximum advantage of our technology that we have available, that it really will be most beneficial if we are in the same facility.
Follow. It would seem that many banking operations have branch offices everywhere, and I'm having trouble getting my hands around why they need to be physically in the same location. They can be physically in the same location electronically, but why do they have to be physically in the same location? That would indicate that in a banking operation that all the facilities should be in one place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's true. I think if you look at the banking industry, there was a push from an efficiency basis and a management perspective to eliminate a lot of branches, and there was a movement away from branches. And they found that to be that was a very poor marketing move on their part. And they realized that there's a certain amount of inefficiency relative to that they need to incur. I won't dispute that it's possible to manage the organization remotely like that, but I can assure you we can't do it as effectively as we can if we manage them in-house and be able to take advantage of all that we have to offer, of jointly managing mail, the various infrastructure that we support it like that, ready access to my banking section and the accountants that are available there, to our controller and the CPAs that work for her, that I can make unclaimed property work better, but I need to have access to unclaimed property to make it work better. And if they're across, if they're in a different building across the way, by its very nature, they won't get the attention from Treasury. Just physically, it won't be there that they will get if they're part of our facility.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I think the only other thing that really I don't believe was brought out relative to the management that we could bring was we talked about the effective deployment of technology and the fact that we are adept at administering fiscal staff and maximizing the value that they add to the organization. It's also important to note that we have a dedicated internal audit function. And I think that's led directly to the problems that DSL did have, was lack of internal audit oversight and attention to controls. And that's something that the Treasury prizes greatly, and you can see that reflected in our commitment to internal audit resources. So that would be brought to bear on this organization as well.
Senator Johnson.
A question to DSL. As part of this suite of reforms that you were directed to implement as a result of a couple of sessions ago, do you have internal audit capacity now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, not to the extent that Treasury does. I think in DSL's budget, and I'm not as familiar with DSL's overall budget right now, but I believe there is a option package in that budget to bring an internal auditor on board for the agency.
That would, I believe that would cover the entire agency, though, not just this program.
I believe so.
Yeah, that raises, I guess, a whole other question, and that's legislative oversight of instructions given to agencies. You're charged right now with taking care of unclaimed property. If one of the issues that Treasury is raising, that where you're deficient, was internal audit, and you guys haven't addressed internal audit, my question is, why not? If the legislature was concerned earlier on about the degree of your custodial oversight and custodial ability, and if something as obvious as audit hasn't been addressed, that to me seems like a pretty significant deficiency in DSO.
That's probably not something that this committee can
I won't ask response to just let it stand.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, on page 22 of our presentation to you is a performance measure, and it is actually the performance measure from the Department of State Lands and what they have currently for their program. You'll actually see two lines on that chart, and as you've heard from the presentation, we are anticipating that the move to the Office of the Treasurer and the awareness that that will bring will increase the receipts of the program, and hence, instead of the DSL target, which is growth at 3%, we project that just the transfer and the awareness, the publicity, if you will give a pop to the receipts. So we project an 8% increase the first year, and then we would project, again, based on all the things that you've just heard here, that we could, on an ongoing basis, be looking at a 5% increase. In aggregate, so that would be a 5% and a 2% increase over their measure. So what I'm trying to say is we're looking at actually a higher bar for this program than is in place right now, and that's because we believe that the changes of bringing the program into the office will in fact increase the receipts and to be accountable to you at that higher level. Mm-hmm.
Maybe just in summary, I know this is a little awkward because the policy bill isn't before this committee. It may be, I was hoping it might be by the time we got down here to do our budget. It did pass just recently. This is very, in my mind, a very simple thing. It's a better alignment of government, which I think is something we all should be striving for. This isn't a criticism, and I wish Senator Johnson was here, of the current program. I think DSL has changed some things and have made it a better program. We're talking about making it a great program, and that's where we believe we have the capacity to do that. And in the long run, this will be a program that we all can, again, share that will be something we can be proud of. And I'm not taking away from what they've done. It's really, there's a limitation to how much that department can enhance this program. Better lining it, putting it in my office long term will be the right thing for this. The land board's already agreed that's the right thing. We, again, believe this will be for the benefit not only of the unclaimed property people out there who have unclaimed property to find them, but also the long term to help schools. So that's why we're here. And I don't know, again, when this policy bill will be discussed, but that's why it was part of the budget. It's part of DSL's budget, which I know you don't have. But that's the parallel path we've been on, and that's why it's before you today.
Senator Bates. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We may be in this discussion actually getting down to what I call the nitty-gritty here, which is you feel your agency can better handle these unclaimed property, these funds, and DSL. And, you know, it might be nice for the committee here to have some detail of why that would occur and what kind of changes would occur in handling this property, inventorying it, keeping track of it. I don't know, maybe you turn it over faster, whatever your plans are, but not right at this moment. We've got like 3 minutes left. And maybe you can give us some detail in a written form we can look at to say, these are the things we're going to put in place, you know, for auditing, for taking care of this property. At a certain point, you'd probably sell it off if it's not claimed. All those kind of things. Do you think you could actually increase the receipts on this? Because that's what you just said, I believe. And I'd like to hear some detail of how you think you're going to accomplish that. Because if you really can improve at 5 or 7%, annually, that's a significant change. But a little detail might help sway us that this is a proper thing to do. Thank you.
And that, I believe we're done with our budget presentation, unless there's other details.
Representative Crummell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the performance measures for a moment, if I may. Under the unclaimed property program, you've got POP 101, and I'm looking back in the performance measures, and I see number 14, amount of unclaimed property reported and remitted annually. We have some percentages in the first part of this table showing being actually over the target. But then when we get to the year 2006, it shows a monetary amount and then shows targets in monetary amounts as opposed to in percentage amounts. But I think the other thing is, in the overall look at this, so what is the anticipated outcome? I mean, so it's at 5.4% in 2005. In 2006, we expect to have $33,525,213. So?
So
what? Where does that go? What's the outcome? Is that saying that we're going to have $33 million to put into the common school fund that then is sent out to school districts that's not part of the state school fund? What are we saying here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, at a very high level, we're looking to maximize the return or the receipts of unclaimed property. So that's what you're seeing across this line. The benefit of that is, as the treasurer indicated, every dollar that comes in doesn't get claimed. There's a period of time that it sits. So the advantage of more receipts is more dollars sitting in the common school fund, earning the rate of return that you saw yesterday when we were talking, when Ron Schmitz was here, earning a higher rate of return. That return doesn't go back to the property owner. That return stays with the common school fund. A larger common school fund means more dollars available for the distribution to schools. So the end result is more dollars in the common school fund growing to benefit schools.
Clarification, Mr. Chair?
Clarification.
If one of the pieces of unclaimed property that comes in is a stock, let's say it's Microsoft stock, and it grows while it's in the possession of the state. Let's say it splits and it grows, and so now let's say, for example, it has doubled. Does the state hold that split if the owner of that then comes forward and claims the unclaimed property, or does the split and the increased value of the stock actually go to the claimant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, if it's still in stock form, then the split would go to the owner of the property. If we have we hold stock for a certain period of time and then make it available for claim for a certain period, and then we sell it because we can't manage a portfolio, and so the proceeds from the sale of whatever number of shares were there at the time of the sale are what are available to the owner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, by law, there's a certain time period by which they will hold the asset and then they sell it. And she can explain that process, and then those proceeds are part of the investment portfolio.
But then, after the stock has been sold, and there's proceeds, and then the claimant comes forward and says, gee, you're holding property of mine, then what they actually get is the cash value that you receive from the sale of that stock.
That is correct.
Right. So I go back to my original question, the outcome. I think one of the things that we were pushing on this last year and JLAC very hard, I know Senator Schrader has been pushing on this, Mr. Chair, but when we're looking at performance measures, we want to see what the outcome is. I mean, What's the anticipated outcome? So what? I don't care if we've got 5.3% over 3% growth. In other words, we had a target of 3%, but our actual was 5.3%. So what? That doesn't tell me anything. What tells me something is, what's the anticipated outcome? Where is this supposed to take us? Why is it beneficial to the citizens of the state of Oregon? Is it because we can reduce the reliance on property tax because of the function of the common school fund? Or is it because we can create a capital construction fund out of something in the common school fund, and therefore local districts won't have to rely as heavily on property taxes? I mean, give us something that's tangible, that's an outcome that we anticipate, and that's what we're shooting.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me rant.
I'm just about to get you.
Okay, we are adjourned.